swear at me, you little shit! Don't you ever raise your voice at me! I am your mother! Do you understand? All I do is worry and slave and defend you, and all I get back is that fucking face on your face! So full of disdain and resentment and always so annoyed. Well, now your sister is dead. And I know you miss her. And I know it was an accident. And I know you're in pain. And I wish I could take that away from you. I wish I could shield you from the knowledge that you did what you did. But your sister is dead. She is gone forever. And what a waste. If it could have maybe brought us together or something. If you could have just said, I'm sorry, or faced up to what happened. Maybe, man, we could do something with this. But you can't take responsibility for anything.
Welcome to part two of our Hereditary episode. But before we go into real talk, it's time for PP, our patron pitch. This is where we let our patrons know what they can expect on their exclusive patron feed. And we also let non-patrons know what they're missing out on. So, month of April, and Alex, as we were discussing right before we started recording again, it's an odd feeling knowing that half the things that we are supposed to be putting out in April are already recorded. Not edited yet, but we're kind of like halfway there. So let's start with some
of
that.
We took a big risk. Like, we just have a lot of faith in that any of the actors we highly praised in these things aren't going to be viciously canceled by the time the episode drops.
It's true. We've been taking that risk every month. Let's start with the biggest thing that's going to be available to every patron. A big undertaking, big production wise, scheduling wise, and it's also, well, I guess for us, it's been a long time coming. I don't know how listeners were obviously not privy to the behind the scenes, but basically, the bonus episode for April, available to everybody, starting with the dollar tier, the Travoltis, all the way up to the $10 tier, the Gads. Everybody gets access to the bonus episodes. And this month, it's a conversation about the Lars von Trier, Jork collaboration, Dancer in the Dark, a movie that Alex has referenced constantly on the main feed, on the Patreon feed. Now, what makes it special is that we're having all three filmbusters coming over to discuss it with us. And these intercontinental collaborations, they take a while to plan. Man, you guys just listened to us and Chaz talking about Kill Bill back-to-back two episodes, but that took a lot of planning. Mm-hmm. And with the filmbusters, there's three of them. So that was a lot of coordinating and canceling. If they were not canceling, we were canceling. And if neither group was canceling, the world was throwing a curveball at us. But we finally got it done. So,
spoiler, there's a ranging difference of opinions.
As there should be. You don't want to hear five people agreeing on something. No, that would be pretty boring. Exactly. So don't worry. That's not going to happen. So Dancer in the Dark, that's our bonus episode for April. Also, as far as stuff that's available for all patrons, we have the Cutting Room Floor segments. That's anything that doesn't make it to our main feed. Patrons get it all. So you're going to have access to that. And then, of course, you also have access to the chat, which we've been trumpeting because that's where a lot of you give us your feedback. And Alex, you were challenged somehow, I guess, by perennial challenger Ryan, who said Alex would be fuming if you watch 70s horror films on the podcast. And I was like, I don't know about that. I think that he would disagree with that statement. But I guess Ryan was anticipating your reaction to Hereditary. And I think he might have been trying to compare Hereditary to 70s horror. So there's a talking point for real talk coming up soon.
I guess.
Now, if you want more content, then you get more content by upgrading. The $3 tier, the Winonis, will give you access to our pre-recording notes. We'll give you access to our quick video reviews. This month is a dual video review. Glengarry Glen Ross, demanded by patron Ben Murray. This is, and we discussed this on the recording, this is his number one movie of all time. And we watched it. We discussed it on video. So you guys will have access to that. And you will also have access to Contrarians After Hours. That's the spin-off show where we tell you about other things that we're watching, that we're listening to, that we're playing, that we're thinking about. Alex, what are you bringing to Contrarians After Hours this time?
Well, I recently discussed on After Hours the Peacock exclusive series based on a true story, which I was not very complimentary of. So I'm trying to reverse the fortunes and talk about something positively. So I recently binged a Peacock exclusive series called Killing It, starring Craig Robinson and the girl who played Birdie on Love. I said that on the After Hours in talking about based on a true story. And you think I would have learned the actress's name by now.
She's Birdie.
Claudia O'Doherty. She plays Jillian G in the show. Should just start calling her Jillian G. A very strange show. Very strange. And it's a comedy and just kind of, I'll explain why it's weird, but it's weird in kind of a charming way. Tim Heidecker is one of the main characters and, you know, I'm a fan of his. So Killing It is what I will be discussing. Are they killing it? Or do they just kind of wound it?
Are they talking about Craig Robinson's career or are they talking about comedy?
So that's what I'm bringing. What about yourself?
Alex, I went to see Wicked on stage. It's my third time watching it, so I'm going to tell you about it. Not so much, I mean, I'm going to tell you about the show, but I also want to use that as a door into a conversation about the fact that the Wicked movie adaptation is finally happening. I think it's already, they finished shooting. It's supposed to come out this Christmas. Part one is supposed to come out this Christmas. I think the patrons might have already heard me complain about the fact that they're splitting into two movies, but we'll talk about that. We'll talk about how I think that the adaptation, what the problem is going to be with the adaptation, what I'm excited about with the adaptation. Jeff Goldblum is playing the wizard. That sounds awesome. So we'll talk about Wicked and also going from a very, very new project to a very, very old project, at least by our standards. I finally watched School of Rock, the Jack Black, Richard Linklater movie.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I have thoughts and it's thematically linked to Wicked because before I watched the movie School of Rock, like, I don't know, 3-4 years ago, I think it was pre-pandemic, I watched the School of Rock musical on stage. So I did it backwards. So School of Rock, Wicked, and Killing It. That's going to be of the After Hours. And then if you want to be part of the elite patrons that get to tell us what to do on the main feed and on the Patreon feed, then that's when you join the $5 tier, the Embrys, and the $10 tier, the Gats. And then you just... They were your puppets. You're just pulling the strings and telling us what to do. So go to patreon.com/contrarianprime, look at what we're offering, and see how you would like to join the Contrarian Supplements.
$1, $3, $5, and $10 are respective tiers. We have other things to plug here, so I'll just say if you head on over, you'll have access to everything we've done since the beginning, our mini-series, our bonus episodes, notes, everything Julio's outlined. And we have our current patron goals that when we cross those thresholds, we have some new projects that you'll unlock. It's like a new level. So as I've been saying, if you're on the fence, now's the time to join because I'm pretty fired up about this next project that we have on our hands. To our current patrons, thank you. We love y'all. And now's the time to do it. Now's the time to join. Fire it up in the chat. Let me know. Julio, continue with our plugs here.
Well, speaking of things that we're fired up about, and we mentioned in the last episode, Live Stream for the Cure is coming. This is the 7th year, 8th year? I don't know. It's been going on for a while. Nick Haskins and his team, they just live stream for several days in a row and raise money for cancer research. And it's a great thing that they do. I like to say that it's one of the most worthwhile things I do every year. Just Alex and I, for an hour, we are part of it. We go live and we do a variation of our Contrarians shtick just there while people comment and play along and donate. Some even donate money. So we'll have goals for like we do every year. We'll have goals as far as donations, as far as participation. The main thing right now for you is to clear your calendar so you can you can be part of the live stream for the cure. You can do it at work. You can do it, you know, just have the live stream playing in the background and just check in from time to time. It's going to start on May 29th. It's going to go all the way to June 1st. So that's 4 days starting at noon, ending at midnight. A lot of people raising money for cancer research. Our segment is on June 1st, the final day. at 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. A lot of you listeners are on the Central time zone because you're with us here in Texas. So Central is 4 p.m. 4 p.m. Central, 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll go for an hour. All of you international listeners, any of you that are not in the U.S., just do the Google thing and just type 5 p.m. Eastern Standard Time and see how it translates to your country. Now, as far as what we're doing, we'll get into the nitty-gritty as episodes go on. As we go on, we're like 2 months away, basically. But we'll tell you, our segment is going to be the Contrarians versus Disney, animated Disney. So get ready. Just make sure you're available to get on your computer. You probably do it on your phone too and just participate. It's going to be a lot of fun. Now, Alex, with all that good stuff out of the way, let's go into something that maybe it's not as good. let's drive into the telephone pole that is Ari Aster's Hereditary for some real talk.
What happened?
Well, according to us, it's not good. The 90% on Rotten Tomatoes and the general sentiment of the masses would tell us otherwise.
We are the 10% in this case. I think that this is not a surprise to anybody that knows us a little bit and who listened to Contrarian's Corner. I think that we did a pretty piss poor job of hiding our true emotions.
Yes.
Still, to what extent do we not like Hereditary? And it's it for the same reasons that we put forth in Contrarian's Corner. That's what you're about to find out. And I mean, we're going to talk about it. This is not about being funny like Contrarian's Corner. This is about trying to figure out what is it that doesn't work here. Maybe you'll help me figure it out, Alex, because I'm still wrestling with it. But before we do that, maybe we'll get some insight from some rotten quotes from the Rotten Tomatoes website. So let's start with Jaime Fadeluca from Culturamas, who says, put quite bluntly, Hereditary is a fiasco.
I like that.
Yeah, calling it as he sees it. Next, Terrence Johnson from Le Noir Auteur. Hereditary is a tense picture, but one I found ultimately unfulfilling. Were you ever tense, Alex? Just like dropping the Contrarian's Corner facade. Were you ever tense while watching this movie?
I mean, there's some good jump scares, and obviously there is the feeling of helplessness and urgency that's there when he's trying to drive his sister to the hospital. And, you know, jokes aside, that sequence is very crushing.
Is that the best scene in the movie? What would you say?
Probably. Yeah, because I couldn't stop laughing during the I'm your mother scene. So this movie's a mean-spirited movie, and that sequence in particular is mean-spirited, but it captures emotion well.
I mean, there is, and we'll discuss this, there is a place in cinema, right, for mean-spirited movies.
Oh, yeah.
I think that as long as they justify
their existence. Dancer in the Dark, baby.
Yep. I didn't want to go back to Lars von Trier just after we plugged him 5 minutes ago, but it's exactly that. Yeah. All right. Next, Rob Dean from Daily Grindhouse says, hobbled by a lack of cohesive narrative execution, Aster has ultimately made a very strong debut that shows a great talent for filmmaking, but one that would do with some refinement on the script level.
Well, I got some bad news for you.
We are three in, my friend, and I think he's still writing his own movies. So that might be a problem.
They've gotten less refined. Well, and again, I haven't seen Bo as a Scaredy Cat, but my understanding is that one's very self-indulgent.
All right. We're going to close with Rosaline Trihane from Liquid Marmalade, who says, how do you know when a film doesn't deliver in a particular genre? The audience starts to laugh at scenes that are supposed to be genuinely terrifying. I don't think that Toni Collette's Oscar clip is supposed to be terrifying, but I think you're not supposed to laugh when Gabriel Byrne catches fire, and I did.
It is so, because by that point in the movie, I was just done, and it is just so like ridiculous. I meant what I said. The level of fire he catches is comedic. It looked like he said, hi, my name's Gabriel Byrne, and this is Hereditary, and then went up in flames.
Dun, dun, dun. Not the biggest problem with this movie, though. It's just something that's easy to point at and laugh. I said we we probably were not as coy about our true feelings as we usually are in these episodes during Concerns Corner. And I also, towards the end of Concerns Corner, I alluded to the fact that I was really starting to delve into real talk. But I also told you when we stopped recording, I said, look, I knew this was a potential issue when I was watching the movie and taking notes. And my notes for Concerns Corner were almost just like a direct translation of my thoughts about the movie in general. That's fine. I mean, this has happened in other episodes. But also, I'm like, look, the real challenge and really the way to approach real talk for me here was like, this movie is 90%. And this movie is not, you know, to quote you, Alex, this movie is not Hancock.
No.
So, and Ari Aster, he doesn't make movies that are for me, but he makes movies that are for a lot of people. And he is not making sequels, remakes, prequels, whatever, you know? And so I want to try to I really want to give his work a chance, and not anymore in the sense like, you know, I'm not going to watch Ball Goes for a Walk. I'm not, you know, it's just, I've seen Hereditary and I've seen Midsommar, and that's, you know, that's it for me. But I don't want to, I could easily spend real talk just talking about the things that don't work and Hereditary and why they don't work for me. And I will get into that a little bit, but I also want to talk about the things that work and the things that could have worked and what I think he's trying to do. And I want to give him a chance because I don't want to be this guy that just completely closes off to new emerging voices. I don't know if we're going to be talking about Ari Aster 20 years from now. It could be like a 3 and done, 4 and done eventually, you know, flash in the pan, sort of the same way that, you know, we talked about The Lighthouse at the beginning of Concerns Corner. Same thing, you know, Robert Eggers. It's like, yeah, The Lighthouse is not for me. The Vivitch is not for me. The Northman was not for me. You know, at some point you just come to terms with it. But still,
I don't know. This next Ari Aster movie's got Joaquin, Pedro Pascal, Emma Stone, Austin Butler.
I don't care.
I don't either. I'm just saying he might be here to stay.
Yeah. I mean, and good for him, and good for people who like his movies. But
yeah, get paid, brother.
Yeah, but okay. You know, let's talk about it. You're pretty negative on it as well. I think you might be even more negative than I am, and it's that thing that you were referencing. You know, you are the horror fan out of the two of us, and so for you, you're like, this is nothing. I've seen this before. I've seen it and it was more engaging.
Yeah, which makes I don't understand what Ryan meant by that. Like, he's one of our like most engaging fans. So I think he would know that my favorite movie of all time is a horror movie from the 70s. also Suspiria, Carrie, The Exorcist, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, obviously. Repulsion, although I think Repulsion's from the 60s, not the 70s. Black Christmas. I think that's where I can start, though, off of his confusing point of contention with me. it's because I have watched a lot of horror movies from the 70s that I don't think Hereditary is particularly good. I've seen this 100 times. Exorcist is a good example. Like, it's obviously the curse of the Exorcist doesn't flow back and forth. Suspiria is a better example because that movie's about witches and shit and about, you know, the spirit taking over certain people and whatnot. So I don't know. It should be a point of pride that I've seen a bunch of horror movies in my life and have a bunch of like points of reference in a genre that typically is, you know, viewed as kind of back at the store. And so in this example, you have this young filmmaker that people seem to think is like the second coming and some great artiste. And then you give them a good chunk of money to make a movie. And so it looks good. And then you get a bona fide A-lister, one of the best actresses of her era, and Toni Collette in this. And she is good in this. And then for namesake, you got Gabriel Byrne just chilling in the background. And then you make this movie that's just a standard possession movie or, you know, witchcraft, etc. But then you add like the thinnest layer of metaphor to it about it being analogous to mental health and, you know, how that's hereditary and you can't escape your past and you can't escape, you know, the family that you have. And then people just come in their pants about it. And it's just kind of like, okay. You know, and in the end, like we talked about, the whole effort to explain everything that's happened in the movie because you don't trust the audience's ability to keep up with it. What was the point?
You are Paimon, one of the eight kings of hell.
If your movie is going to end up just being another cult movie and a movie about witchcraft and shit, what did we spend all that time fucking around with mental health, like, and about, you know, our family's histories and shit? Because that has nothing to do with the trappings of just a generic cult movie. It's like they set up something. It's not like, to me, this movie sets up something fairly interesting, and then it just becomes another, oh, all right, burn them at the stake. And it offends me on some level. I need to quit citing The Exorcist, because obviously The Exorcist is held in regard as like one of the greatest films ever made. So it'd be ridiculous for me to act like it's not. You know, Suspiria is a good example of the original one, that is. And it, because I'm sticking in the 70s now because Ryan pissed me off. Or even like The Omen or something, you know, just thinking of that. It's, I have seen this done dozens of times before. So for me, when I watch this, knowing the way people went crazy about it, it's just kind of like, okay, you know, Avatar, the first Avatar, for example. Yeah, I'd seen that movie 20 times before I saw Avatar, but at least it was like, holy shit, look at this. This movie is just like, all right, Toni Collette's good, but that's it. Like, this movie's boring as fuck. And anything interesting that it sets up, it abandons in the third act. And then it takes just all the most cliche elements from its genre. But for some reason, people think it's groundbreaking and shit. And like I said, I would much rather a movie end in 90 minutes with me going, huh? Than a movie like this be 2 hours, me being like, oh my God, I fucking get it. Just wrap this up. I want to go home.
Okay. But there's a lot of angles here. Because, you know, I have all these questions for you now, Alex, so get ready. Number one is, would you be more charitable towards this movie if it wasn't so heavily acclaimed? Because then you wouldn't have that whole thing of like, okay, has anybody ever seen a movie before? And instead it would be just like, okay, so this, you know, this stuff I've seen before, but it's not, people are not trying to sell it to me like I should be blown away by it.
I don't think I'd be as loud. I don't see a scenario in which I enjoy this movie.
Okay, that's fair. That's fair. But I was just wondering how much, because I know, I mean, we're just human. And I know that there is a part of me, not so much with Hereditary. It happens more with Midsommar, where the in-your-face praise, the enthusiasm from the people that love it, it can kind of add to my annoyance with the movie itself. And it's like, well, you know, can't be helped. It's, you know, it's part of the experience. People tell you it's so amazing. You're like, no, it's not.
Yes.
Now, but here's something else. And this is where, you know, maybe we cut the movie some slack. And that is that you've seen a lot of horror movies. And so you recognize those things. And so those things, even when they're well executed, are a lot less effective or have a smaller chance of being effective on you because you've seen all those movies. But we have to acknowledge that there are people that are younger or that are just less experienced in the genre, or for whatever reason, they are more likely to just be wowed by a well-executed horror movie, even if it's just basically assembled parts from other movies. I mean, most movies are assembled from other movies. We just did, you know, a Tarantino two-parter. So I guess, you know, I don't want to rake Ari Aster over the coals just because his movie is not this wholly original creature. In a way, it's not his fault that there's a lot of critics and members of the audience that are treating it like that. It just, you know, he made a movie. I don't know. I don't know. I've never heard him talk about Hereditary or Midsommar or the other one. But I guess I just want to give it that.
Yeah, that's, again, it's like with Midsommar. That's my thing with a lot of wrestling now. Like, I get it, dude. I'm outdated. I've been passed by but I know what's back here. And that seems to bother me that not are our tours of today, but our going public of today doesn't seem to care what's back there. And it's like, ah, fuck it. I'll just watch this instead. And I know how unbelievably pretentious this makes me sound, but it's true for both you and myself and the majority of people that would listen to this. And should I take it as a compliment that I've spent half of my life watching a screen with movies? Probably, you know, I should probably reassess that. But I also have context to compare shit to. You do as well. And that's, we come across this and it's like, okay, I've seen this before. And it frustrates me. We had this discussion in our remake series that we did. One of the things you brought up was, well, you know, it might encourage people to watch the original, and in theory that works, but it's not going to. And, you know, it's like Suspiria is like a cliche at this point. So I shouldn't harp on that too much. Cause that, like that, if Hot Topic was still a thing, they'd be selling t-shirts with Suspiria on it. So, you know, Alice, Sweet Alice or something. I'm just trying to think of horror movies of that time that have been repeated to death since. And with something like this, it's exactly what I said, is just like, well, I would just watch this instead. But this movie has also been praised by a ton of people in their early 20s who grew up on the remake era, honestly, just the remakes of Friday the 13th and Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Amityville Horror, My Bloody Valentine, et cetera, that also didn't have access to things like Monster Vision on Friday nights on TNT, or just, it's just a generational thing. And I'm the old guy and I get that. So when this, something like this comes out and people go gaga about it, and then I see it, I don't blame Ari Aster. This dude's getting bank now, man. And he's getting to work with all these folks. And, you know, he, in the two movies I've seen of his, he would probably tell me that, you know, it's his take on
the
movies of yesteryear. And so I guess when my, where I get on my soapbox and when I take out my bullhorn about these things, it really is just from a place of like, when people say it takes horror in a new direction, or it's one of the best horror movies ever, that's like, okay, let's calm down. It's like the TV show. It's like when people, you know, still people watch The Simpsons and say it's great that never watched seasons 3 through 8. And it's just like, okay, well, pump the brakes. Now we're crossing a line here. You can like what you like, but when you make these declarative statements that aren't true, then that's where someone like me, who has this vast array of useless knowledge, I'll be like, well, hold on a second. So this is the biggest crime this movie commits as far as me watching a movie and taking all of that out of it is just, I find this profoundly boring. It is just so slow. The score has no emotional engagement to the story itself, and it just takes for fucking ever. And I know our longtime listeners are shocked that I'm saying a modern movie is too long, but dude, come the fuck on, man. It's just, it's too much. So at this point, I've expelled my animus about the praise that it got. And now I'm just critiquing it from the perspective of just a movie that I'm watching.
Right. You've expelled like the issues, the personal issues. And now you're, you know, just like End Out came over like from across the street.
And now, and now I rolled up my sleeves and I said, now let me tell you what's really wrong with this.
You tried to kill me.
Why did you try to kill me? I was trying to save you.
Okay, before we get to that, because I think that we agree on.
I do have positives, by the way, to those listening. I'm not just going to. Yeah, me too.
I just wanted to set the table, or rather put this in context, because I just want people to be aware. I just want to make it clear to listeners that we are aware that there's a lot of stuff that's just our baggage, and that's mine, you know? Like, I don't have the horror background that you do, and so I've seen this before, whatever, it's not as strong in my case, even though I do feel it. But even if it was, I think that I'm at a point where I can just use that to explain to you why a movie doesn't work as strongly with me as it does to somebody who doesn't have those experiences. And that is not a failure of the movie necessarily, a failure of the filmmaker. You know, it's just a thing that is. If you make a movie that is not executing at like an amazing level and it's made of very familiar components, then, you know, I'm going to be like, yeah, it doesn't work for me because I've seen this before. I've seen it done better. But that's not the movie's fault, you know, because the movie is for somebody else, obviously. Now, that's it.
Also, there's a big difference also because there's so many mediocre movies that are just movies you've seen before. But when you watch something like this that you know it's trying really hard to be like deep, like there are levels to what we're talking about because there's plenty of movies that are just X recycled that I really like. So yes, but the biggest thing you said is correct is a lot of people, especially people like Julio and I, are very fairly passionate about it, bring their own reads to art. We talk about that, I think, a lot.
But that said, you can also, there are times when those same elements, the recycling, the recognizable elements work for me, work for you, right? Like our last episode was Fighting with My Family. And we're like, yeah, that's just like a collection of sport movie tropes. That's fine. Had a good old time with it. It's shorter than Hereditary. Even though it's like 90 something percent fresh on the tomato meter, it's not the, you know, nobody's claiming that it's taking sports movies
and
or
similarly
movies
I brought direction. A lot of baggage to that, and I exercise the demons in that one as well, but it's not a movie that tried to like reinvent the wheel, so I was like, yeah, it was fine.
Yeah So there's, you know, those are kind of like external factors. Now I'm actually not surprised, but that was, I guess I thought that this was going to be my thing, but it is yours as well. The idea that there is it's pretty obvious, I guess, with it, you know, that this is a movie that is one type of movie, and then halfway through it becomes a much less interesting kind of movie, even though it's, you know, that's when it becomes, I guess, a horror movie. Before that, I was feeling it like a drama, right? And I guess I thought that you were going to go, well, at least in that second half, it's a horror movie and, you know, it had some scares and whatever. And I have zero interest in that. So even, you know, whether a visual is disturbing or not, the first time I watched it and now this time I rewatched it, I felt that the movie completely loses everything that was interesting to me the moment that you start just throwing in these demons and these things that I just have no interest in. And I had a similar experience with another pretty well-received movie. Did you ever watch The Babadook?
No, but I remember, you weren't a big fan of it.
Yeah, but I was for a while. The Babadook, and it's been a while, but from what I remember, it's the single mother with this kid, and she's just having a really hard time as a single mom, just, you know, getting through life. I think the dad passed away or something, and then there's weird things happening in the house, but for a good chunk of the movie, and when I was enjoying the movie, I enjoyed it because it was like, yeah, there's these supernatural things happening, but really what you're feeling is the struggle of being a single parent, right? Like she's like sleep deprived and it's always tired and the kid is so needy, and she just, that was like what the movie was about for me, right? And then at some point, almost inevitably, the movie becomes about, it really starts focusing on the supernatural stuff. And I was like, I don't care. I don't care about the ghost, the monster, whatever's happening, because what I really care was the story of the single mom that's like, can barely make it. And this is like that, except that this is worse. Because The Babadook, it's, you know, it's a better movie, holds together better, I think. This is just that the change is so abrupt. And I think, along the lines of what I said in Contreras Corner, I think it's because the Ari Aster decided to design his movie to be like very surprising and shocking in that last 30, 40 minutes. And so that makes him withhold information that maybe would have helped people like me flow into that supernatural climax a lot more easily, because, you know, we are armed with, you know, we knew what to expect in a way. Like Hereditary for me is at its most captivating when it's about this woman, this whole family dealing with grief in very dysfunctional ways. And it's not about that at all. The last, you know, in the third act. So it's kind of like what you were saying. It's like, what did we do that for? You know, what was the point? Why do I care? The idea that this woman, that Toni Collette, has to suffer through the loss of her mother, who she had like a very complicated relationship with, and then almost back to back the loss of her daughter, and then she's left with a son that she already had a complex push and pull with, and now she, on top of that, now she has to reckon with the fact that he is responsible for the death of his sister. I mean, that is really heavy stuff, but it's interesting stuff. You know, if you're going to make a movie about that, I'm going to watch it. And, you know, you have good actors and you have good moments between them. So when you have all that and then you throw it away so you can have Toni Collette like banging her head against the attic door, I know I shouldn't, but it kind of makes me angry. And you know, but there are people going to tell me like, it's your fault, man, because you didn't know what, you know, it's a horror movie. You should have. That's what we're here for. We're not here for.
So horror movies can like be one, they can be good. And two, they can have a constant theme and consistency is the word I was looking for there. Yes, it goes from like an interesting movie about like depression. And so like. Melancholia, for example. I'm sure some people would consider that a horror movie. I mean, it's about the end of the world, so yeah, technically you're like, but you can make movies about depression and about real issues that it still qualifies as horror or, you know, thriller or whatnot. I mean, maybe they could have done something like hallucinations begin, and you know, we get some of that with like the nightmares scenarios and shit like that. But exactly what you're saying, dude, for it to just become the fucking Ring at the end of this, you know, just this tried out, recycled. Again, it's possible that 80% of the people that went and saw this movie had never seen anything like that before, but you and I, it's just kind of like, okay. And to your point, more so. Yeah, they have Toni Collette have like these multiple Oscar scenes, and then she has to react like she stepped on a nail, like she's Marv in Home Alone, like the way she sells like Gabriel Byrne catching on fire. And then, yeah, banging her head on the door and shit. And it's just, and even the, I enjoy the practical effects, like I said, but the idea of her getting that piano wire and cutting her own head off, like everything happens so fast. And it's just like, why not? I think I said that out loud the first time I saw the movie. I was like, okay, fine.
And the mythology that they just plop on you in that final, you know, 10 minutes, 20 minutes. I don't know. I mean, I guess from the moment that she finds the book, but really it's just entire, it's really the climax when it just goes off the rails as far as the amount of world building, I guess, that it's trying to do. And I'm assuming that people that like this movie think that this is an asset, right? That you just learn all this stuff and it gives you all this context for what's been happening in the movie. Oh, it was a trickster demon that was looking for a new host. And it was actually, I guess, it was living inside Charlie, but only temporarily, because really the real goal was to live inside a male body. And so that's why Charlie had to die so that he could eventually transfer to Peter. Man. Who cares? I guess you care. Like, not you, but, you know, you 90% people.
The royal you.
Hail Paimon!
Hail Paimon! Hail Paimon!
I think, and this is me trying to be positive or at least understanding, okay, I think that maybe you can make the argument that it's not that the movie's badly constructed. It's just that this is a type of movie, right, where you front load the emotional side of it, the character development. It's just that's at the front. You know, if you came here for a movie about grief, well, that's what the first hour is about. But after that, do not expect that to carry on to the wild shit we're going to do with the ghosts and the demons. Maybe that's why it's groundbreaking, Alex, because it's just revolutionizing story structure. You get your veggies in the first hour, and then you get the
give me the veggies.
Yep. And then the second hour is just apple pie and ice cream. If you're into that kind of stuff, whenever I hear people talk about like the you know, how awesome Hereditary is, it's always, not always, but it's mostly focused on those final moments and the imagery. And I don't like the Toni Collette becomes a monster thing at the end, but I know a lot of people do. And it has to be, it's not because she's putting on a great performance. It just has to be because it's a strong image to see her do those things.
Ain't no one ever seen something like shocking at the end. Y'all ever seen Blair Witch Project? Fuck's sake, man. You guys never seen something surprise. Never seen The Departed? Never seen something shocking at the end of a movie? All right.
Good stuff. Good stuff. Toni Collette.
Toni Collette is awesome. Toni Collette really is, like, by the end, yes, comedic. But everything up until that point, the scene where she, you know, shares her sorrow is really, really impactful. Mm-hmm. And dude, the way she sells the seance, the first seance, so good. When she, like, I don't want to be here. Like when the glass moves or whatever, the way she just freaks out is really good. And then, yeah, like jokes aside, that's everybody. Sometimes one line of dialogue can be tainted from an inside joke from 20 years ago for somebody. But that SNL thing did kind of ruin the big dinner scene, but she's very good in that also. And then like, the scene where she's working on her models while she's listening to the voicemail she got, and she like breaks one of them. Like she's on fire in this, but we're not breaking ground here. Toni Collette's the shit.
Yeah. There was a kind of a generalized outrage when she didn't get a nomination for this movie.
And I bet there was.
Yeah. And you know, you want to talk about familiar stuff like the familiar argument of like, oh, it's just because it's a horror movie. And maybe there's something to that. You know, it's like comedies, horror movie, I guess genre movies don't get it's harder for them to get recognition at award shows or whatever. And of course, if you're asking me, I'll be like, oh, well, no, it's because the movie let her down. But at the beginning, not even the beginning, like, you know, the first half, and I not having that SNL point of reference, I really like that dinner scene. I think that it just hits so hard. It's well written too. Ari Aster, I'm about to give you specific props. I think it's very well written. When the way that she confronts her son about how she feels, and you know, she is very honest about what she perceives as her failings, but also very honest about what she wants from him and how he is failing. And that is a type of honesty that, I mean, I'm not saying that it's good or bad. You know, obviously, I'm more on the Gabriel Byrne side of like, can we calm down? But dramatically, you know, you don't really see people have that kind of be so eloquent, articulate, I guess, about their pain and their frustration and the way that she just unloads on this kid. And Alex Wolff, also props to him, because he just his shocked reaction to it.
His physical acting in the scene where he's possessed in the classroom is pretty dope.
That's prosthetics, right? His face, when we go back to him.
I think he was just doing an Elvis impression. But, yeah, I guess I don't know. But when he's like herking and jerking around is great. Dude, yeah, I had a hard time keeping together when you said Ann Dowd was like Michael, because she really is in that one part. She's just like standing across the fucking football field like, the power of Christ compels you.
Toni Collette, I don't know that she would have. I guess I don't know if you have the nominees for Best Actress for this year, but I was not up in arms about her not being nominated. But also, I didn't have a problem reconciling reality with that, because obviously I didn't like the movie to begin with. So, but it's still a really good performance. I like Alex Wolff, and I even like Gabriel Byrne. I think that it's that's my SNL, Alex. I think it's funny to see him play such a mild-mannered character. I get it. You know, I in a way, I kind of applaud that he takes this approach to a character that is in such a wild
story. He is the closest thing to, like, the history of horror movies in that he's the doubtful, just non-believer that anything's wrong. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
He's like, this way. He's like, oh, no, Freddy Krueger's dead. That can't be.
But he... It's just so weird, because I think that you could keep the script the same way, but you could play him a little stronger and it would be a very different experience. Here, he just feels, man, he comes across as so much older than Toni Collette.
Yeah.
And I know, obviously, this family is going through a lot from the first time that we meet them, but still, he just, I want to know, like, was that Gabriel Byrne's idea? Did he come to Aster and go like, hey, how about I play him like he is just so beaten down even before things get crazy? Or if it was on Ari Aster told him, look, I know that your instinct is going to be to try to match the energy level of Toni Collette, but I don't want you to do that. I want you to just downplay it and just be tired. I don't know. I mean, I think it does the job. It's an interesting footnote, because if I think of Gabriel Byrne's performance here, it's going to be something that I guess didn't expect him to do, which was to do very little. I guess that makes it memorable in its own way.
Sure.
Not going to get an Oscar nomination for that.
Nah. The poster also sucks, where it's Toni Collette, black and white, ominously, her head over her daughter's head.
So the daughter, Charlie, the big moment. For me, the big moment is not the...
Oh, she's really good.
Yeah, she's great. And her death is, you know, like we said at the beginning of this segment, I think it's the best moment in the movie, because it's self-contained in a way, right? Like, I don't need a further
payoff.
Oh, this
is the only movie she's done. Okay.
Is it? Huh.
She's done some stage work, it looks like, and a few TV shows. But yeah, this is the only film she's done. Wow.
I mean, whenever she's in another movie, she's going to have to play a radically different character. Otherwise, yeah, people are going to be like, oh, Hereditary. I didn't know about, you know, I said, I went in back row blind. So when that scene happened, when she got decapitated by the telephone pole, I probably screamed in the theater. And I wasn't alone. I mean, you know, it was like a...
Oh, yeah, it's pretty shocking.
Yeah, I didn't see it coming. And at the time, I remember thinking, okay, this is going to be great, because we are not even halfway through the movie. You know, your expectation is like, okay, we hit this peak. I can't wait what happens like an hour from now. So that was a good moment. That's always like a good memory I associate with Hereditary. Like, just no matter how it disappointed me later on, just that sequence of him driving, and you just don't see it coming, and it happens, you know. Did you have a similar experience, or did they spoil for you that what was going to happen?
I knew, like, the clickbait screenshot I talked about. I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, oh fuck. It was very surprising. I do think showing just the head on the ground getting eaten by bugs, I'm like, what's the point of this? Because it really is just, like I said, it's as purposeful as one of those loading screens in Grand Theft Auto that just shows a character. If that had been the thing Toni Collette discovered or somehow tied into the rest of the story, fine. And again, you're talking to me, someone who loudly trumpets gratuitous violence. But for a movie like this that tries to be so real, to come across as like you're trying to be exploitative of the kid dying in this movie to the point of like, look at it. It's just kind of like, okay.
I was going to say, it just to make it clear, because I joked about it in Contreras Corner, I was kidding. I mean, I think that it's the right choice, and it's a very effective choice to just stay with Peter, with Alex Wolff, yeah, through the entire thing. And you only hear Toni Collette discovering the body. It's such a restrained way of shooting it that's also why it's so jarring when you see the head. It was like, you didn't need it. You already had us. You know, you executed perfectly, and then you couldn't resist it. It's like, I'm just going to give you the head anyway.
But in the moment, yes, it's very surprising.
Pull up those Oscar nominees, because I really want to know who they wanted to kick out of the nominees to make room for Toni Collette.
Oof. Oof, brother. I've actually seen a good amount of the Best Picture nominees from that year. All right, so 2019 was the year that Green Book won.
Off to a terrible start.
And in the Best Actress category, the nominees were Melissa McCarthy for Can You Ever Forgive Me?, Lady Gaga for A Star Is Born, Glenn Close for The Wife, Yalitza Aparicio for Roma, And Olivia Colman won for the Favo You Write.
Man, I've seen them all. I think I was rooting for the lady from Roma. She was great. Olivia Colman was really good in The Favourite too. Makes sense that she would win because it's kind of like a scene stealer of a role. Those two are, you know, they're not going anywhere. Glenn Close in, what's it called? The writer? The wife?
The wife.
The wife. Yeah, she's the wife of a writer. She's good. I don't know they needed an Oscar nomination, but I remember at the time, everybody was thinking, this is it. After all these years, this is the one. And then she didn't get it. Lady Gaga, I mean, there was no way that she wasn't getting nominated because it was like such a big deal that she was in a movie and, you know, that it did so well. And she's good.
She's pretty good, yeah.
And then Melissa McCarthy, it's her second nomination. I guess it's kind of like a reward because Can You Ever Forgive Me? It's actually a very toned down comedy compared to what she'd been making. I don't know. They need a nomination. Maybe that's the one. Her or Glenn Close. If you're going to, you know, push somebody out to get Toni Collette in, one of those two. But Hereditary is definitely a lot less traditional than any of those five performances and movies. So I don't think it was in the cards, as you like to say.
Well, it's all right, because I wouldn't really want to be associated with that year of the Oscars anyway.
All right. So, Alex, what's your rating for Hereditary?
I had to go back to my Letterboxd review from the night I watched it. I gave it 2 stars, saying Toni Collette is obviously very good and props for practical effects, but oh my God, this movie is boring and about as subtle as a frying pan to the face. And to feed into what I was talking about, I was going over people I follow on Here's Reviews, and this person who shall remain nameless that told me that they didn't watch horror movies. They didn't really think they were on par with the others. Gave it 4 stars, talking about how great it was. And I was like, okay, so that kind of sums up what I've just been going on about for the past hour. So, by comparison, in that same month, I gave London 2.5 stars. C-, again, taking everything away from it, having watched it twice now, taking all of the baggage away from, you know, my perception, I still just think it's really boring. And I think there are positives to it, the biggest one obviously being Toni Collette, but C-, this one, I don't see myself coming back to this again. Yeah, you, sir.
I won't be coming back to Hereditary. Twice is more than enough. I am glad that I rewatched it because that's one of those things where, you know,
I feel more just in my opinion now.
Yeah, well, and also it kind of confirms, because you had that experience. You always talk about Juno, right? That you watched it before the hype, and then the hype happened, and you're like, wait a second, did I? Yeah, you know, did I get it right the first time? And so that was me. I watched Hereditary before everybody was talking about it being a game changer, and then everybody hyped it the hell up. And I've been wondering, not too much, because I have very specific memories of my feelings. And whenever somebody praised a movie, they were not really addressing the things that bother me. So I had a feeling how this rewatch was going to go, and it went that way. But now I know for sure. It was like, no, it really is that issue of the story not being what I wanted. And what it is not a movie for me. So I'm also going to go with 2 stars. That first hour is really where it's at. And if you want to hone in on that sequence where Charlie loses her head, I mean, that's 5 stars from beginning to end. And then, man, the last 30 minutes is like 0.5 star, if that. Way off the rails towards the end. For context, by the way, I think that I find Midsommar boring. I think it has a better ending, but Midsommar is just... Hereditary, I find frustrating. Midsommar, I find boring. And it has a similar issue in the sense that it has an opening that makes you think, oh man, we're about to explore grief in a very brutal way. And then it just meanders into something else. The difference is that in Hereditary, it happens in the last 30 minutes. And in Midsummer, it happens. You
happens
know.
In the last 7 hours.
Yes.
I am your mother. Do you understand?
All right. That was Hereditary.
It was, and we've definitely left ourselves prone and vulnerable for the Hereditary fans to just attack us like we're scarecrows covered in Cheetos, and they are, you know, ravens coming to peck our eyes out. But
Alex, we were so worked up about this that we didn't even mention good friend and patron John Amenta from The Pint, who's the reason we're doing Hereditary.
Oh, God bless you, John. You know we love you, so hope you take it as a compliment that we were so fired up about the movie you chose that we just moved right along.
Yeah, John, I don't know if you like this movie or not. I have a feeling that you do, but we'll see. Let us know. Let us know, and we'll address this on the Patreon chat or somewhere. We'll sort this out.
And in a closing addendum, I realized for our A24 Mount Rushmore, what do we have? We had Lighthouse, Hereditary, Spring Breakers, and then we may have to cut Uncut Gems because we have to put everything everywhere all at once because that won Best Picture, and that's yes. An A24 movie. So there you go. You
just perverse. Push Sandler, we got it straightened out of it. Yeah. They weren't even finished, like, chiseling his face into the mountain. No, nope, scratch that. All right, cool. We're done with this.
Well, what's next?
Coming up next, a movie neither of us has seen, and we are barely familiar with it. It's called Things to Do in Denver When You're Dead, featuring Andy Garcia's face and presumably the rest of his body.
I would hope so.
Yeah.
He's Tony Collette at the end of this movie.
Yeah. I don't know. I like Andy Garcia. I don't think that he's been on the main feed. We did, was it Desperate Measures? That movie with him, Michael Keaton, we did on the Patreon feed.
Oh, yeah. That was fun movie.
Yeah. So hopefully he rises to the occasion here. Oh, you know what? We've had him in the main feed for like 5 seconds. And that was him at the end of Passengers.
Oh, yeah. And that movie is written by Scott Rosenberg, who famously wrote Con Air and High Fidelity. And for the purposes of The Contrarians, he also wrote Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, which I covered in a QVR.
He also wrote Beautiful Girls.
And Venom.
Okay, well.
Oh, God, Beautiful Girls. That perverse yeah. movie you made me watch.
The early days of the patron. All right. Sounds interesting. This is demanded, requested by Ben Murray. So, Ben, we'll get your thoughts before we record on this. Should be a good time. Andy Garcia. We need more Andy Garcia on the main feed.
We'll see about that.
Yes. Anyway, let's get out of here, Alex.
Welcome to our end credits.
Or as we usually call them, our perennial plugs.
We start off by giving thanks to the Festive Years, who provide our opening and closing tracks. They kick us off with Last Stand and take us home with Summer of 99. Be sure to head over to thefestiveyears.com for any and all Festive Years needs.
Our friend and fellow podcaster, Hans Rothgeiser, is the man behind our logo and all the art you see related to our show. Reach out to him and let him know how much you like that little tomato. His email address is mildemonios@hotmail.com and his website is mildemonios.pe. That's mildemonios. You can also check out his podcast, Nación Combi, about Peruvian current affairs, and Marginal, about economy. Hans, thank you for all your support.
For those interested in the regularly absurd world of professional wrestling, Joe and the boys over at latenightgrin.com have you covered. Tell them the Contrarians sent you.
And we'd like to close with special thanks to our social media team of Zoe Perez and Corey Ari. Each of the social media accounts we mentioned in the introduction look as good as they do because of their work.
So that'll do it for this episode of The Contrarians, where we're right and you're wrong, and we will catch you next time. Just promise me the way.